Okay, right. Now, how do I do this again? Oh, yeah. Okay, here we go. Kia ora and welcome back to the Airman's Podcast. This is episode 254, and it is Tuesday, May 24th, 2011. I started this episode at least three times before, going all the way back to April 29th when I started it, and obviously didn't finish it nearly a month ago. Actually, that's not true. I did finish it once. I had it pretty much ready to go, and then at the last minute decided there was something I wasn't happy about, and I was going to do it again. And, of course, one thing leads to another, and that just doesn't happen. But there's nothing wrong. I'm not pod fading. I have just been busy or not had the, wherewithal to get with it and finish it. Now, this episode is called User-Defined Content because I've received a number of phone messages that raise questions or ask questions, and I thought that I would today address those all at once, apparently. It happens. But first, I do have some items from the news that I wanted to share, and the first of those goes back to several months ago now, the Pike River mining tragedy. An agreement was reached yesterday as to how they are going to go about retrieving the bodies in the mine. It hasn't yet been worked out who's going to pay for this, mind you, but nevertheless, it is going to happen fairly soon, probably in August, I think it is, when they're going to make the attempt to start going in there to get them. Whether they succeed or not is a whole other issue, but that's down the road. So that's in the works. Another thing in the news is got to be one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. The Wellington Airport has decided to put a sign on the side of the hills that face the airport that says Wellywood, which is kind of a nickname that a lot of people have for Wellington because of Peter Jackson's studios are there, and he makes at least parts of his films there. And so it's kind of got to do with that, except that it doesn't mean anything outside of New Zealand. Nobody who would hear Wellywood and automatically think of Wellington. And none of us can believe that they're actually going to do this. They pushed it through as a non-notifiable thing. They didn't need to go to the people for comment and so on because they said that the impact would be negligible and nobody would really care anyway. Well, the country's up in arms about it and they're going to go ahead and do it anyway, saying that the people who are opposed to it are just a mob. Well, this mob happens to pay the taxes in this country, and they vote in this country. And unless I'm grossly mistaken, I believe the airport is publicly owned. So, we ought to have a say in this sort of thing. Certainly the people of Wellington ought to have a say in this sort of thing. And apparently the powers that be have decided otherwise. So, of course, that's led to all sorts of jokes about things that could go in other cities, like they could call Auckland Awkward, which, of course, leads to awkward. But that's not going to happen, by the way. So it's just a colossally dumb idea. The sign is supposed to look a lot like the Hollywood sign, as you would imagine. But it doesn't say anything. Marketing experts have essentially told the airport that they're insane for doing it. And it's a total waste of money. I mean, the economy is still in recession, and they're going to spend money on a stupid sign when they, could use it to improve services at the airport, for instance, to make it more attractive to tourists. Tourists going to Wellington, generally speaking, aren't going there for the existence of the film industry. They're going there for Te Papa or to visit Parliament or whatever it might be, or just because it's a pleasant city, but not because of that. So it's just silly and a waste of money. But those are just a couple of things in the news. There's a lot more in the news. There's a lot of stuff going on with the political campaign and so on. And I'll talk about that in future episodes. I'll try to group those together as much as possible rather than just do little bits and pieces now and then. But one last thing I said in the last episode, lo, those many weeks ago, that the Prime Minister John Key had taken a helicopter to Auckland for a black tie dinner at a golf club because the protocol said that he couldn't arrive after the Governor General. Well, it's since emerged, that was their excuse, it's since emerged that that's not protocol, that that's customary, but it's certainly not chiseled in stone, and there's no reason he couldn't have arrived after the Governor General. So there you go. But I do have a whole bunch of phone comments and some written comments to get through today, and I'll get started with that. without any theme music. I've been told that the one I was using has got to go because it just doesn't fit. And the truth is, I resurrected it because we don't get calls over in Too Political. I gifted it to Too Political. And I wanted to use it a few more times before Glennie retired, and or actually before his firing took effect. But I think that's pretty much run its course now. And until I come up with a new one, considering how often I put out episodes, I wouldn't hold my breath for that. I'm just going to go without any intros or segment bridges or whatever you want to call them. So here's the first of the phone messages.
Hey, Arthur, it's Colin Hoy. Listen to your recent podcast. Sounds a lot like East Maui. What is it? The Hidianga? Or the quote-unquote ex-hippies live. The pot growing coincides with that. Not to mention the twisty, windy road that almost always causes children to get sick. Well, we have the same thing, which I happen to live off of. The road to Hana, the Hana Highway, which is sort of the main stretch that skirts along the North Shore, encircling East Maui and then coming back around towards the South Shore, facing the South Shore. It rings the crater. And on that road to Hana, that is windy. It's a two-lane road, and that means locals and tourists alike have to travel at whatever speed the person in front is traveling at. And usually tourists act like there's a fucking raptor that's going to pop out of the bushes like Jurassic Park and tear their car to shreds. So they drive extremely slow and very cautious, and locals like myself have to endure following them while we're trying to get to some place on time. But out my way sounds a lot like the town organic farmers market, which would probably be Hana Town, although we've got organic markets all around the island now, sort of spreading. And alternative sort of living that would be on the road to Hana, past Kanai, past Hana Town or village, whatever you call it. It's not very large. The big tract land spread out between Native Hawaiian families as well as ex-hippies and celebrities. But the town of Kipahulu, that would be the sustainable living, lots of rich fashion designers, actors, actresses, you know, well-to-do individuals that have moved from the mainland and transplanted here, and not necessarily here very often, but sort of their escape from the rest of the world. It's only accessible from the one road on that side, and the way out is, it's a two-lane road as well. Tons of potholes and sheer cliff, no guardrail on a lot of sides. That is shut down for a while when we had the big earthquake because boulders had been removed from the upper cliffs and had destroyed parts of the road and the bridge had cracked. So I know exactly what that's like. It's sort of living out in the boonies as I do. But anyway, I enjoyed that and I would like to hear your thoughts about green harvest because it's a very sore subject over here. In fact, there's some sort of campaign bumper stickers, you know, slapped to signs inside the buildings that say, thanks to green harvest, Maui's hooked on ice, which is exactly what it's right. They've federal funds focused on, military helicopters scooping up people's plants that don't have licenses for. Well, meanwhile, ice and meth houses are running rampant. So I'd like to hear your point of view on that. Have a good one. Hope you and Nigel and the fam have a wonderful weekend. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Kyle. I actually don't know what Green Harvest is. I don't know if that's a U.S. term or what. But we have a similar situation here where we have the military. Well, it's usually not military. It's usually police using their helicopters to get these marijuana plants and destroy them. And I have always thought it's a waste of resources because it does nothing to stop the growing and selling and smoking of marijuana. And I've always thought that it would make far more sense to legalize it and regulate it so that you can control the farming. It would get legitimate taxable income for the farmers. the sale, again, more tax income, and you would be able to control who specifically gets it in the same way you do alcohol, which is not to say that people would be able to get wouldn't still get it illegally as people underage kids get alcohol. But the point is that the majority of it would be controlled and taxed on several at several different points along the process. So it seems to me like that's a much more sensible solution. And that would free up resources to go after the clearly serious drugs. And far and away, the most serious drug in New Zealand is methamphetamine, which we call P, which stands for pure methamphetamine. I think Australia calls it ICE. And I would much rather see the resources used in combating that than on combating marijuana. But that's just me. There are plenty of people who don't agree with me on that point. But thanks for that, Kyle. And the next call is also from Kyle.
That's another thing I wanted to say. Like you were saying, that sounds exactly like the place I would like to visit in New Zealand. But I had a question. The town of Kipahulu and Hana Town as well, although it's mixed with a lot of transient individuals or individuals from the mainland or all around the world, with completely different perspectives, a lot of them have a lot to do. Some of them were just, you know, hippies that have either leased land or bought land early and have just sort of lived sustainably or off the grid, off the map for quite some time. But there's also the local Native Hawaiian families that have lived out there, sort of one of the last places on the island, you know, around the Halapa Crater, that same opposite that side, there's the west side, that certain pockets of Native families still hold together. And I know there's a lot more Native visibility in New Zealand than there is in Hawaii. But there's sort of a symbiosis and community building that goes on out in Hana and Kipahulu and not so much out where I live, Kailua. But it's actually fairly interesting to see that, you know, the environmentally conscious or sustainably conscious and even, you know, spiritual, head in the clouds individuals is sort of, there's a grounded sense in a lot of them, and they've worked together with the native families, I want to say native, just locals that have lived there for generations to encourage community growth and a real sense of community. At that same time, making it possible for developments not to take over necessarily out there, which is the opposite as far as Lahaina, the west side, where, you know, is there just catering, as well, Kihei, south side, just sort of catered to individuals that want their third or fourth house or their retirees, a lot of conservative money. Whereas the east side of the island is very liberal, or if they are conservative, they're very community-oriented and very environmental, far, far left leaning. But it's very interesting, sort of the dynamic that exists. They're not not that bad, a lot of them. But anyway, that's a bit of how I grew up. Love the podcast. I'm interested to hear more. Take care. Bye.
Well, thanks for that too, Kyle. And the Coromandel generally is very similar in many respects to what you're describing. It, generally speaking, is a fairly politically progressive part of the country, especially northmost. And when I'm talking about the year-round residents, the local, some of the others, however, are not necessarily, because it's made up of the Coromandel Peninsula is made up of a lot of areas of the south. It's got a lot to do with the farming region, which is conservative, National Party. And further north, you're more likely to get more progressive people, especially, well, again, it's the year-round residents. And the reason I make that distinction is because there are a hell of a lot of Aucklanders who have holiday homes in and around the Coromandel Peninsula, somewhere in the peninsula. And they, because they tend to be wealthier, are very often more conservative. Now, as I said a long, long time ago, in New Zealand, you have two votes for local elections. Well, we don't necessarily, but you may have two votes. One is your individual vote wherever you live. That's true for every permanent resident in New Zealand gets a vote wherever they live for the local council. However, if you own property somewhere else, you also get one vote for the household. So, for instance, if we had a holiday home in the Coromandel Peninsula, Nigel and I together would have one vote that we could do for mayor and the council and so on. And it's an interesting idea because essentially what it amounts to is making sure that taxpayers are represented in local government. But since they don't actually live there, it is a bit dodgier because they're potentially making decisions about the people who are going to be deciding things for everyone who lives there, in particular the people who live there year-round, and they're the ones who are going to have to pay for it as well. So it's kind of a weird situation. I frankly don't know how I feel about it. But anyway, that's the way it is. But the Coromandel has a history of being a little more left-leaning, partly because of this sort of leftover hippie thing. It's the, as I said before, it's the only electorate in New Zealand that ever elected a Green Party MP as an electorate MP. They've always been list MPs otherwise. And that was for one term. But still, I mean, you can't discount that at all. And but overall, the electorate, because it's not just the Coromandel Peninsula, it's right-leaning, not left-leaning, because it goes down into the Hierarchy Plains to the south, and that area is farming country. It's mostly dairy farms, some sheep farms, but mostly dairy farms, and very conservative. Farmers tend to be very right-wing. They tend to vote national, and which is our current party of government, and it's a conservative party. And even though it's against our own best interest, but we won't go there. It's a whole other topic. But there is kind of a sense of community in the peninsula itself. And again, once you get north into it, particularly in things like trying to stop mining, it's a gold mining region. And there are always these pressures to go there and remove hills and mountains in order to get at the gold. And they've successfully fought it off each time. And but it's always under threat, particularly under a national government, which quite frankly isn't really too terribly concerned about restricting development. So that's always a trade-off of a tension that goes on there. But for the most part, Coromandel is a fairly maybe not progressive anymore so much as liberal-ish kind of place. Probably more so than any other specific geographic region in New Zealand. I mean, there are areas of the country that are solidly Labour Party, for instance, but that doesn't necessarily make them politically progressive because there are conservative Labourites as well. The current leader of the party, Phil Goff, is a conservative. He's not quite as right-wing as Julia Gillard in Australia, but he's pretty conservative. So just because it's a left-of-centre party, centre-left party, as they like to say, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily progressive politics, but that's getting in a whole other topic, which I'll go to another time. But thanks for that, Kyle. Now, on to the next call.
Hey, Arthur. This is Ramble. Just thought I'd give you a quick call. I'm taking Starbucks for a walk, or really a drag, the way he's acting. He's all hyper. And, of course, it's windy as I start to make the call. So I just want to call and say hello and hope you and your wonderful Nigel is doing well. And I will talk to you later. Just want to give you a quick call to say hello. So, you be good. Goodbye.
Well, thanks for that, Tom. And that's Tom the Ramble Redhead from RambleRedhead.com. Have I ever mentioned that Tom is the only podcaster I've ever met in real life? I don't think I have. Well, anyway, he is. And now, it's on to the next call.
Hello, Arthur. This is Roger. I have a question. Apparently, if the United Kingdom wanted to change its rules about primogeniture, from being male primogeniture to gender-neutral primogeniture, they would need the approval not just of the UK government, but of the 15 other countries for which the Queen is currently the monarch. So my question is, if there was such a vote in New Zealand, would it pass, and how problematic would it be if in the process of, are there a lot of royals down there who would complain about it or whatnot? Anyway, that's my question. Thank you. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Roger. Interesting question. And you're quite right that the other countries that have Queen Elizabeth as their monarch would have to pass that as well, I suppose. The Prime Minister has already pledged New Zealand support for that law change if the British Parliament decides to go that route. I actually don't think that the average person in New Zealand really cares much about the rules of succession for the British throne. However, most of them would probably take the sort of commonsensical approach, like, well, why shouldn't it be the firstborn child regardless of gender? Why should it be just the firstborn male, even if it's like the eighth child or whatever? Kiwis are a lot more practical about most things, and that's certainly one of them. I mean, I've talked in the past about republicanism, small r, thank you very much, here in New Zealand. And even among people who aren't necessarily Republicans, there's sort of a, for lack of a better word, disinterest in the royal family and the monarchy specifically, not necessarily the royal family. So I don't think there would be any problem whatsoever. There's certainly, I haven't heard a single person say, oh, they mustn't change it. It must remain the firstborn male child, because that's not the sort of thing the Kiwis would think. So it would have absolutely no problem getting approved by New Zealand if that's the way they should decide to go. And quite frankly, I think they should. But that actually kind of relates to a question that's asked in the next call. So let's go on to that one.
Hi, Arthur. It's Bink here. I hope you're well. I just called to say hi. We're in the last stages of getting ready for our trip to New Zealand. Very exciting stuff for us. And if you get a wild hair and decide to come down to Dunedin, we sure would love to see you. And then I was wondering if you had watched the royal wedding. I can't imagine it wasn't quite a big deal in New Zealand, so I'm intrigued to know whether you watched, and if you did, whether you found it moving or not. I guess as a New Zealand citizen, you are, like me, a subject of Her Majesty. Do you think that you felt any visceral response to it? I found it mysteriously moving, although I could not begin to explain, let alone justify that. So I guess I just have to leave it that it moved me and I don't really understand why. So that was just on my mind. Hope you're well. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks for that, Benk. If I remember correctly, Benk and her husband are going to be in Dunedin for, I think it's 6 months or something like that, on a special contract, which is very exciting for all concerned. And since she'll be in the same time zone as me, it's entirely possible it might be more easy to arrange to have her on the show. We'll see how that goes. It's probably more likely to still be over Skype or something, because I don't know that we're going to make it down to Dunedin anytime soon. It's been a very long time since I've been there, though, and it's actually a lovely part of the country. Dunedin itself is a nice place. It's the home of the University of Otago, among other things. But also you can go up the Otago Peninsula, and there's a yellow-eyed penguin colony there, which is fascinating. And there's also, further up, at Tairua Heads, there's a royal albatross colony. And royal albatross is a kind of albatross, it's not like Her Majesty's albatrosses or something. And that's a fascinating thing in itself. So it's a really interesting place to visit. And I don't know that sometimes that it gets the attention that it should get. It's sort of, I don't know. Queenstown and Christchurch are probably among the better known areas in the South Island. And it's a bit of a shame, really, because it's really quite a nice place. But now, as to your question about the royal wedding, it was a very big deal in New Zealand. I don't know that all of it had to do with royals or what have you. I think it was mostly hype. It was a pop culture thing. It was, you know, sort of a phenomenon. But I know a lot of people had royal wedding parties. Our niece did, and she didn't invite us, if you can believe it. But they had all sorts of drinking games as well, and one of them, I think, had something to do with when the Queen smiled. But be that as it may, I always find weddings moving. It's something about watching two people publicly pledging their love for each other and commitment to each other always gets me. It doesn't matter who it is, if I know them or not. I always find that moving. However, I have noticed that in recent years, there's always this little thing in the back of my mind thinking about how everyone is behind the couple and they're all cheering for them and pulling for them and so on. And yet, even though New Zealand has civil union laws, and obviously you can have a civil union ceremony, marriage itself is something I'm forbidden to do, either here or in my home state of Illinois. And I'm always aware of that whenever I'm at a wedding now. And that's not to say that I wish ill on the couple or that I'm jealous or anything like that. It's just I'm aware that there's this separation between what I can experience and what they can experience, for whatever that means, whatever that's worth. I don't know, you might hear the dogs barking in the background. There's something going on outside in the park, and they decided they have to talk about it. But yes, so we did watch the royal wedding. I did find it, at least sometimes, moving. I thought some of it was a bit of a circus. But, I mean, something that big would be. But I do remember one of the things I was thinking that, because I remember watching his mother's wedding way back in the day. And I couldn't help thinking that she would have been proud of him. And I couldn't help thinking that, you know, some of the things that we heard about during the whole process about how he was protective of Kate and the various things that he insisted on and so on. And I thought, good on him. And I thought, you know, he's standing up for himself more so than any of the other royals had before. So he may still be the hope for the future of the monarchy. And I think I've said before that I think most New Zealanders would rather that he be the next monarch than Charles, but, you know, it's not up to us. So that's that. But thanks for that, Bank, and I hope I get to talk to you soon once you are in the country. But now we are moving on to the next call.
Hey, Arthur, this is Roger. I'm just fascinated by the fact that I'm calling you on this phone, and you're going to be halfway across the world, and you're going to hear this message. I think I'm thinking about that because I just watched the Endeavor launch on my computer, and it reminded me of the fact that I used to sit in front of my TV watching the space launches, and then after a while it became routine, and I stopped watching them. And until we had a couple of disasters, and I became more interested in watching them again, oddly. So, anyway, I'll talk to you. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, Roger. And, of course, that is sort of another one that keeps my phone line going. Because, as you know, if I don't get a call every 30 days, it dies. And Roger's been really good about keeping my line running, almost single-handedly sometimes. But that never ceases to fascinate me as well. Sometimes I will Skype chat with my sister and turn on the video camera so that we can, you know, talk face to face, basically. And that's kind of fascinating too, realizing we're on different sides of the planet and yet still able to see each other and speak to each other. And it is fascinating. But, you know, talk about the space launches. I'm sure I remember watching Project Mercury launches, and I certainly remember Project Gemini and Apollo, of course. And I had a toy Gemini rocket when I was a kid. I remember the capsule was red plastic. And I don't know what ever happened. Well, I don't know what happened to any of it, but I don't know what happened to the rocket part, but I had the capsule part for many years afterwards and enjoyed it very much. It was one of my favorite toys as a kid. It also had a rescue helicopter that it came with, a blue plastic rescue helicopter. But space and space exploration were a very big part of my growing up, which is probably, I think, part of the reason why I'm so fascinated by technology and pushing the envelope and pushing towards the future and all those kinds of things. But anyway, well, thanks for that, Roger. And now on to the last call.
Hey there, Arthur. This is Scott, a.k.a. Sader69. And I'm just calling to say hi because I haven't heard your show in a week or two now. And I wanted to make sure you were okay. And I wanted to keep your voicemail line alive for a little bit longer. I really adore you and your show and all that you do for Pride 48. You have a great day, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that, Scott, and thanks for keeping my phone line alive. I'm always appreciative of people keeping my phone line alive so I don't have to ring it. But you talked about what I do for Pride 48, and I would have to say that Scott, a.k.a. Sader69, is doing a heck of a lot more for Pride 48 these days than I am. He's one of the people who has been doing, encouraging would be the word, people to participate. He's participated in some of the live shows that have been on. He certainly does a lot of audio booze, or has done a lot of audio booze, and sort of has been fostering these connections between and among all these various podcasters who are part of the Pride 48 family. And that's really what it's all about. Pride 48 was never intended to be an organization. It was never intended to be a traditional top-down management structure kind of thing. It was always intended to be a community effort, more like a cooperative than an organization. And Scott's certainly done a lot to help promote that ethos, if you will, that way of looking at things and doing things. And it's added a sort of vibrancy to it, particularly since he got involved, that people's enthusiasm wanes, ebbs and flows over time, obviously. And some podcasts fade, some podcasts come back. But it helps to have a new burst of enthusiasm every now and again. And Scott has certainly done a lot to help push that. And so has Nessa from the Hello Nessa podcast and Gavin from Poke It With a Stick, as it's called now, and many others, too many to mention. And I don't want to go down that route or I'm going to start forgetting people. But thanks for that, Scott. I do appreciate it. And I also appreciate what you do, your podcast, as well as what you do for Pride 48. Now I'm going to go over to the site where I have comments on the last episode, which was called Missing Holiday, which is back in April. But the first comment is from Hat M, who says, no, I don't understand. If New Zealand is the land of secularism, or sort of, why is it that Easter Monday is a holiday? I'm sure people would want it to stay like that, but why isn't it called bank holiday type of name? I suppose this would be a question for any country considering itself secular. That's true. Thank you for that, Hedem. That's true. I, as most people probably know, have some trouble with public promotion of particular religious beliefs. And I don't have a problem with Christmas Day and the day after, Boxing Day, being public holidays, because Christmas has a secular component to it as much as a religious component. So, you know, to me, that's fine. But Easter and Good Friday are particular, not just particular religious holidays, but they are probably the most important religious holidays to Christians. They have no significance whatsoever to anybody else in terms of what they mean and so on. They're just holidays. Now, that is New Zealand's four-day weekend every year, and I don't think anybody would want to give it up. And it is true that Easter and Good Friday have very little religious significance in New Zealand. But it does, on some levels, it does kind of bother me that they are, that they are held in the esteem they are. And I would almost rather have a set four-day weekend every year in March or April or something, and just leave it at that. And if some years it would coincide with Easter, that would be fine. And other years it wouldn't. I don't have a problem with them being public holidays as such, but I do have a problem with the trading ban on Good Friday and Easter Sunday, because that, I think, is taking it to the next level of almost public endorsement of a particular religion. So I would say I would compromise. I wouldn't take the public holidays away, but I would take the trading bans away on Good Friday and Easter Sunday and just leave them as ordinary public holidays. And then some people would be rostered to work those days and they'd get extra pay and so on. But a lot of people would have it off. Christmas is a whole nother matter entirely for me. And I can see leaving the trading ban in place for that, and even Anzac Day morning. But Good Friday and Easter, not so sure. The next question I think I might have anticipated. He says, if Easter is kept as a national holiday, are there other more indigenous days celebrated as a holiday? Because to be fair, if one is, others should be too. See, I have trouble reading without discriminating. And there I'm not talking about Christmas either. P.S. Is indigenous an offensive word? That part first. Indigenous isn't an offensive word necessarily. I mean, a lot of Maori embrace that as a word to describe them. I am one of those people who is uncomfortable with it because of what it implies. It implies not the people who were first to a place, but the people that they originated there. And the only people who are truly indigenous in this world are Africans. Everyone else is an immigrant. And it's just a question of how long they've been in a place. So I'm uncomfortable with the term. I mean, I tend to prefer things like First Nation to describe the people who were first to a place, you know, no matter how long ago it was and stuff like that. But as a general rule, no, indigenous is not an offensive word. But there are no Māori holidays that I'm aware of at all. Anything that had any religious significance was squashed by the Christian missionaries back starting in the 18th century, actually even before that. And so, you know, I mean, there's really nothing to salvage. Having said that, however, there is a festival that's held every year. It's sometimes called the Māori New Year. It's also known as Matariki, or, what it is when the constellation Matariki rises. It is known in English as the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades, and that was an indication to Māori the planting season was coming up. So that was their new year. And that has become a kind of a celebration period here in New Zealand. It lasts about a week, I think, or 10 days or something. I can't remember off the top of my head. But and there's no actually, you know, set rules or anything. There's certainly no specific significance to it. And it does move around a bit during the year, as most things like that do. But it's the same general season. But that's the closest we have to an indigenous holiday of any sort. And, but, I mean, well, I suppose it's better than nothing, but it's not a public holiday. It's just kind of a cultural expression time or whatever you want to call it. And now on to Head M's last question. Why don't people, I mean, any country, not only New Zealand, want those public companies sold? I do understand there's a national security issue, beneficial tax going to the main national pot advantage, and a preservation of countless jobs that would be destroyed in a private sector health services. But why would others care about the public domain? Users' information is used as a private company. And with time and living costs getting higher, public domains will need to restrict their customers to the ones that can pay with extra services. Same behavior as in the private field. Well, actually, I think I should break this up. First, about that part, it's not a given that services will be restricted to those who pay. It does get more expensive over time to provide healthcare, obviously, but it overall our sector is more cost effective at delivering health benefits than the private system is. It's similar to the U.S., where Medicare is much more cost effective than private health insurance. Hands down, it is more cost-effective. And that tends to be true in any public system because you get efficiencies of scale, first of all, and you also get the benefit of universal acceptance, and there's greatly reduced paperwork. There's all kinds of things that go into that. And you've no idea how much paperwork adds to costs. Pardon me. But, yeah, so it is possible if people are wealthy, or they don't have to be wealthy, if they have more disposable income, they can buy private health insurance and get things dealt to differently or quicker than they could through the public system. That is still the case. It's always been the case. However, the average person can still be sure that whatever their condition is will eventually be dealt to. The downside, as I've said many times before, of any public system is the waiting list. And the fact that the people who have the most chronic and serious conditions are dealt with first, and so the people who are in generally reasonably good shape, or whose quality of life isn't compromised, may have to wait a little bit longer in order to get their procedure done. However, there are certain things that sort of jump the queue, like cancer, for instance, because, you know, time can be of the essence. But a lot of times, minor surgeries or surgeries that aren't terribly important might be put off for a while they deal with more important things or critical things, but they don't charge for extra services. That is still an option for those who have money to get private insurance to do that, but that is certainly not something that they have to do. Having said that, there are user pays for other things, other services, particularly in local councils. You have to pay to check out a brand new book from the public library, for instance. Older books you don't, but brand new ones you have to. And there are other things like that. That's all I can think of off the top of my head. I'm sure there are more. But those are things that you don't necessarily have to have. Healthcare is something you have to have. Education is something you have to have. And so there's guaranteed access to those things, and the government has to find ways to pay for them. And sometimes that means that other things, there might be fees on things that you can choose not to do. Anyway, he goes on, you say that the public own these companies. Centuries have proven that not the public owns the public domain, but the government. Any complaint towards officials, any laziness by officials is ignored. Bureaucracy is so high to the normal citizen to understand the logic of it that they would rather not argue. The citizen is taxed with administrative fees, etc. If costs are lowered and aid is given, usually cost is higher for the government. That way, because somebody has to pay for it, the user gets to pay anyway. Well, in New Zealand, that's not true. That's not the way it works. The companies are companies. They're run as companies. They're run the exact same way as any private company would be run. They have a CEO. They've got a board of directors. They've got employees. They're not government employees. They have nothing to do with the government. There is usually a minister in charge, which means that he acts on behalf of the government as the chief shareholder. That's true for Air New Zealand. It's true for power companies. It's true for Kiwi Rail, Kiwi Bank, New Zealand Post, several other companies that are government-owned or substantially government-owned. The government has a shareholding, and so it has a vote whenever things are put to shareholders. But the company is run as a company. The only difference between a state-owned company and one that's owned privately is who holds the shares. And in New Zealand, a publicly owned company is owned by the people of New Zealand through the government. It's not the government, though, because It's not the government, though, because the governments come and go. Every 3 years we have an election, and every 3 years we could have a new government. What we do say in New Zealand is we sometimes say it's owned by the crown, which is a symbol that means the government and the people of New Zealand, not just the government. And we say the crown because, theoretically anyway, it's enduring. It transcends the government of the day because it will be here no matter what, those sorts of things. But the public do own these companies, and they are companies that are run as companies, not as government departments. So they don't have the bureaucracy of, say, pardon me, they don't have the bureaucracy of a government department, say. They have the same level of service as any other company. And when they compete with private companies, they have to compete for customers just like the private company does. There are very few companies, of these publicly owned companies, that are monopolies. Most of them compete in the marketplace. And there's a whole bunch of historic reasons why that's the case. But anyway, the point is that they're not government departments, so they're not bureaucratic in the same way that a government department would be. They are, in every sense of the word, companies. He goes on, I don't see the advantage of citizens owning such a huge company if they cannot change things in it. It is a myth that people through electorates get things changed. Well, I would disagree with that too, because we change things all the time here, and that's one of the reasons why we have MMP, so that it's easier for the will of the people to be done, essentially. We created Kiwi Bank because the people wanted it. The people demanded to have a New Zealand-owned bank as an alternative to all our other banks that are owned by Australians, a lot of the big banks that are owned by Australians. And the main advantage of citizens owning them is that it's like the family jewels. It's always an asset that we have. We know that it's going to be there. We know that they can't take the jobs away from us. We know that we control the decisions that are made by that company, that they have to be made in the interests of New Zealand and not in the interests of foreign owners in New York or London or Paris or Hong Kong or wherever they might be, that it's a New Zealand-focused business. And that's not true of most of the major corporations in New Zealand. Most of them are owned by foreigners. And the other side of that is that because they're owned by foreigners, the profits are shipped overseas. And that creates problems with what is sometimes called the national debt. What it has to do with is the difference in exchange rates between what we hold here in New Zealand and what has to be converted to foreign currency and sent overseas. That contributes to this, not just the trade deficit, but also the balance of payments deficit, and also what is usually called the national debt. So if the profits stay here in New Zealand, that helps our overall financial position in the world, and in addition to helping preserve New Zealand jobs and creating economic activity here in New Zealand, rather than shipping the profits overseas where they may or may not create economic activity in some other country. But as I say, we can change things through our parliament, and we frequently do. And he concludes, I think maybe they're trying to get rid of such institutions because they spend more than they produce. And that's clearly not the case here in New Zealand. They're all making profits. They're all returning a profit to the crown that is more than they would get by selling it. In other words, if they take these companies and they sell them off, first of all, they're gone for good once that happens, unless labor gets in and buys them back again. Once they're sold, they're gone, and the profits and the ownership go overseas. But the other thing that happens is that they end up costing the government more in the long run because of all of the lost assets, first of all, and also because the dividends that they're getting are greater than any government borrowing. So the government is borrowing a lot of money to pay for the tax cuts for the rich that they put through, and they but they are getting more in returns from these private companies than they're paying out in interest. So in other words, even though they're borrowing money to pay for these tax cuts for the rich, they're still coming out ahead because these government-owned companies are making more money than the interest that they're being charged. So it's a win-win situation for the taxpayer, but the problem is that the National Party is the party of big business and farmers, and they want to sell off the businesses to their rich mates, is what it amounts to. It's all about transferring wealth from the ordinary people of New Zealand to the rich, the transfer of wealth upwards. It's similar to what Republicans want in the U.S., but the difference is that in the U.S., they're not as transparent about it as the National Party here is. I mean, everybody knows that's what they want to do. And they're not really interested in the public interest, even though they try to spin it that way. But in a nutshell, that's what it boils down to. You talked about issues of national security, and that's certainly part of it in terms of economic security primarily. The fact that the jobs are preserved by public ownership, but also the profits are preserved for here in New Zealand, whereas otherwise they'd be shipped overseas. And the fact that, we have every right to control these things that New Zealanders built from the ground up. That's especially true if you're talking about things like power companies, because the dams were built with taxpayer money and government labor in some cases, if you're talking about older projects. And if we sell it off now to foreign companies, what we're essentially doing is we're selling off the blood, sweat, and tears, and sometimes lives, of the New Zealanders who built them in the first place for no good reason. And that's really what it comes down to. There's no good reason to do what the government wants to do. And until and unless that changes, I believe that these things should stay in public ownership. And right now, the numbers just don't stack up. They make no economic sense whatsoever for the government to sell off these things. And so I believe we should keep them. And the fact is that the majority of New Zealanders don't want them sold off either. So we'll see what happens. It's definitely going to be a campaign issue in the upcoming election. But thanks, Hedem. Thanks, everyone, for your phone calls. That is it for today. I will be back next time. Yes, I will be back with other topics and perhaps even some announcements. You just never know. You just don't know what's going to happen. But thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon. Really. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amerinds Podcast at amerindspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at amerindspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.